You ever see an olive tree? Ever see an olive tree up close? Olive trees are not a very pretty kind of tree. They can live to enormous ages. They get very old and they get short and they thick and they're kind of ugly. But they produce fruit. They have rough bark and limbs that get uglier and twisted the more they get old. Gnarled, I think, is a word that comes to mind. At the bottom of the western slopes of the Mount of Olives facing Jerusalem are some of truly ancient olive trees. There's the name of the garden, but it was near Gethsemane. I was able to visit a garden of olive trees. And these trees were over 1,000 years old. Over 1,000 years old. Some of the trees that are facing Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives are considered to be closer to 2,000 years old, around the time when the Roman armies surrounded Jerusalem, 70 AD. They laid siege to Jerusalem. They cut down virtually every tree for 10 miles around the city to provide timber for their siege engines and sadly, to crucify many prisoners. When an olive tree is cut down, like a lot of trees, it sends out new shoots from the existing root structure. So it keeps going, it keeps growing. Thus, it's possible that those ancient trees at the foot of the Mount of Olives goes back all the way to the time of Christ. Nearby, not far from the rear of that grove of trees, in the side of the Mount of Olives is a large, shallow cave that archaeologists have explored. In the floor of the cave, they're found remains of an ancient olive oil press. The kind that was used about 2,000 years ago. Excuse me. At that time, workmen had harvested olives from the nearby trees, taken them to the press, crushed them to squeeze out the olive oil so they could use for food, and then for fuel, and even for medicine. In the Gospels, we find mention of a place of the lower slopes of the Mount of Olives, just across from the Kidron Valley, from the temple, a place called Gethsemane. Gethsemane. Gethsemane is an Aramaic word which means an olive press. Gat Shem Anim, which means just an olive oil press. Apparently the cave that they discovered with its ancient oil press and ancient olive trees nearby is that Gethsemane that's mentioned in the Bible. Kind of cool. Those ancient, gnarled, ugly olive trees are in a way representative of events that happened in this very place nearly 2,000 years ago. Events that were themselves quite ugly, unpleasant, and that would have been quite painful to witness, much less experience. In five and a half short weeks, we will assemble together to commemorate the events that took place in connection with the actions that happened around Gethsemane. And before we do that, we are commanded to examine ourselves. Where are we spiritually? Where are we in our relationship with God, Jesus Christ, with one another? To consider the meaning of those events and to reflect on their significance to each of us individually. Well, today, I want to review those events, to have all of us go through them together, to think about them and consider their meaning and implications, and hopefully gain additional insights into what Jesus Christ went through in becoming our sacrifice. And hopefully I'm not going to take too much of Mr. Hill's Bible study. He said he'd just come up, say, read the book, and he'd walk away. No. Every year during the Passover service, we read through the accounts of the Gospels about Christ's last Passover with his disciples. We read about the foot washing and Peter's protest about not just my feet, well, first, don't wash me at all, but then not just my feet, everything about me. We read about Jesus Christ instituting the symbols of the bread and wine that represents him giving his life and what he was going to go through for us physically. We read about Judas, leaving the meal before the Passover, making his final arrangements to betray Jesus Christ. And then we read through several chapters of the book of John where Christ gives his final instructions to the disciples and prays that they would be unified. What's really interesting is that Jesus Christ then prays for you and me. He prays for those who down through the ages would be called. Without knowing us, Jesus Christ prayed for us as well. And finally, we close that service, Matthew 26, verse 30, as Jesus Christ and the disciples close the Passover service that evening as well. We close with a hymn. And we do that now almost 2,000 years later. They sang a hymn and departed. Well, let's go to Matthew 26, verse 30. That's where we'll start. Matthew 26, verse 30. What I want to do is take it from the end of the Passover service, then what happened. Let's take a look at what happened after that. I want to pick up the story where we leave off every year to continue reading about those events, to see how the symbolism of the bread and wine came to pass and take a closer look at Christ's sacrifice for us. So to do that, we'll start in Matthew 26, verse 30. Matthew 26, verse 30. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. It's kind of neat. From the Mount of Olives, you look across the valley. There's Jerusalem. There's the temple. You can see it quite easily. It's not that far. What happens next apparently transpires as they are walking to the Mount of Olives from the house where they had taken the Passover. They're talking as they walk along, probably under the light of the full moon. Verse 31, Jesus said to them, now he's starting to give them additional insight and instruction. Jesus said to them, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. Peter answered and said to him, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. I mean, there was a wonderful physical presence here of pride that I can do this. You don't know me well enough. And Jesus, verse 34, said, assuredly, I say to you that this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. You'll be challenged and you will fail three times. Peter said to him, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And so said all the disciples. They all were fervent in their loyalty to Jesus Christ. They would all defend him to the death, and they would never deny him. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to his disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. Gethsemane was a place where he often went when visiting Jerusalem. It was a quiet place. I love gardens in England. When I was there, we had the Japanese gardens, and when I would get spun up because of classes or not doing my studies and it was an exam, I would go there and get peace of mind. It was just a place that I just enjoyed. It's kind of like my ocean. I like walking in the ocean, get centered. Well, Gethsemane was a place where they often went and visited when visiting Jerusalem. It was a relatively quiet, private place, and Jesus would spend time with his disciples or by himself and focus on what was coming. It was quite possible that during their day there were ancient olive trees, hundreds of years old, dating back to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. I mean, these trees, they're long-lived, ugly-looking things, but they still gave product. They still gave product. So they went to this place, this quiet olive grove just outside of Jerusalem. A string of ugly, twisted events begin. It's kind of like the olive tree. Now we have the events that are also now looking ugly on that evening. On that night and in that place, Jesus begins what would later rightly and accurately become to known as his agony. Verse 37, and he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, James and John, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Notice his state of mind. He is sorrowful, deeply distressed. In other words, he is in mental anguish. He knows what's coming, and there's pressure bearing down on him. It's a huge amount of pressure. Then he said to them, verse 38, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death." To put it in different words, Jesus was so mentally stressed, he wished he could just die now and not have to go through what he was going to go through. "Stay here and watch with me. Be here. Be my comfort. Help me. Just be here." You know, sometimes we have a friend, family member who is in dire issues, and we don't know what to say. My counsel to you is just be there. Just be there. Let them know that you're there with them. Verse 39, he went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." He's not just praying on his knees. He was on his face. He was utterly prostrated before God with his face to the ground. And the cup of suffering that he was going to have to go through was before him. Why am I leading up to this? In Hebrews 5, you can put this in your notes. In Hebrews 5, it says that Jesus Christ learned obedience through the suffering, and it made him perfect, becoming our salvation. Hebrews 4:15 says that Jesus Christ was tempted as we are, but without sin. This is also known as the temptation of Christ, what he was going through. You know, people say, well, it was Satan tempting Christ. This was the true temptation of Jesus Christ, facing ultimate agony. So he's not praying on his knees. He's utterly prostrated before God, and he has the cup of suffering that he has to go through. Verse 40, then he came to the disciples and found them asleep. Oh, these guys, they were tired. And said to Peter, "What, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again, a second time he went and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me, unless I drink it, your will be done." I mean, when we are facing some of the biggest trials, as I mentioned last week, 2 weeks ago, when Jehoshaphat was facing armies that were coming to destroy him, his first reaction was to go to God. Ours need to be the same. We go to God, and then his will be done. "If this cup cannot pass away from me, unless I drink it, your will be done." And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. Have you ever fallen, you just couldn't stay awake? For 16 years, I took a bus to work, and at the end of the day, sometimes I was just so tired, I was leaning into the bus rider next to me, and I would get shoved, and I'd wake up embarrassed, turn red, and then promptly fall asleep again and try and fall back on top. Sometimes the eyes are just so heavy. Verse 44, so he left them, went away again, and prayed the third time, saying the same words. The mind of Jesus Christ right now during this time was of anguish and dread. He was exceedingly sorrowful for what was going to take place. How much do we understand about what Jesus Christ was going through? If Jesus Christ's death was all that was needed, why couldn't he have just died more quickly and more simply? If all he had to do was just give up his life, and it's over. Why couldn't he have done that? Why did he have to suffer so much in addition to dying? As the book of Hebrews tells us, he was tempted in all points like we were, but without sin. He was to go through all the experiences and to feel all the emotions and go through all the agonies that all of us go through, so that he would understand us, being the intercessor in heaven for us. There was no reason why all those agonies should come on him, because he never sinned. And yet it was essential that he know and experience the dread, the pain, the agony, the misery, and come as a result of being a human being. Hard to put that together sometimes when we go to the Passover. And that is part of why Jesus spent those hours in Gethsemane praying and weeping and even to the point of almost sweating blood, because he dreaded what he was going to suffer. He knew the penalty for sin and that he was going to have to experience the penalty for sin for all mankind. He had to have been feeling extreme emotions. He had to experience dread. And there was no other way, because how could Jesus understand us otherwise? You ever had that experience where something was so awesome in front of you, you had nothing but dread, the very bowels of your being wanted just to fall? Thankfully, I could say maybe only once or twice. How could Jesus Christ be our faithful high priest? How could he possibly intercede with God for us when we're afraid, if he doesn't know what dread smells like, what it tastes like, what it feels like, if he hasn't experienced severe emotions that cuts right to the very marrow of your bone? There's a great book called The Night Christ Died. Recommend it. It's a tome that walks you through hour by hour what took place. How could Jesus Christ understand the dread and agony that we sometimes face? Maybe sometimes we face with the doctor tells us something, or our employer is going to wipe out our entire career. Relationships falls apart, and we're going through those kinds of dread and agony. If he didn't feel the same kind of dread, if he just said, "Oh, I was human, I died, and everyone's forgiven." No, it says he was tempted like we were in everything. On that night, he must have experienced great apprehension, the kind of raw, gut-wrenching, stomach-turning dread you would feel if you knew that you were going to walk out of the building alone by yourself and a mob was going to grab you. To haul you away, to beat you, spit on your face, rip your skin off your body, strip you naked, and cold-bloodedly torture you and murder you. There would be great dread. And there wasn't a thing he would do about it. You and I would probably run away. We'd look at some of these windows and they don't matter much. I'd go right through one, I'm sure. You know, you'd see the window there and you'd see my image as it goes through. But that's not what Jesus Christ did. That's the kind of dread, the agony and distress that Jesus Christ would have been feeling the night in the Garden of Gethsemane, surrounded by those olive trees. That's why he prayed repeatedly to let the cup pass from him. Now, the plan was made. The cup wasn't going to be changed. The process was in place. He knew what he was going to do. And he was just expressing the human part of him. You know, if it's possible, but your will be done. For your sake and my sake, he said, "Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." So he had faced this overwhelming, excruciating dread of what lay ahead. Now, Luke records that an angel appeared to strengthen him at this time because of what he was going through, helped him through it. And being strengthened, he rose from prayer to face betrayal by one of his chosen disciples. So he's faced dread. Now he faces betrayal, another trial this evening, continuing in Matthew 26:45. Then he came to his disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. You see, my betrayer is at hand." From the place at the Mount of Olives, you can see across the narrow valley. You can see to the walls and the Temple of Jerusalem. You can see the roads that are coming out of the city, no more than really a few hundred yards away. And I believe that Jesus Christ, while praying that final time, that he could hear the mob coming for him. You could hear the rattle of swords and metal. You can hear stomping feet. They're coming up the hill for him. And the dread would still be there. He also knew that he could have easily run away at that moment and save himself. But for our sake, he didn't. And while he was speaking, verse 47, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs, came with the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, whomever I kiss, he is the one who sees him. You see, Jesus Christ looked like a normal Jew at the time. He didn't stand 6 foot six as a Roman with long hair. That would be an easily identified individual. The average size at the time of a Jew was about 5'2", 5'3". And if you read in Isaiah, he wasn't particularly pleasant to look at. He was just a dude. So he had to be pointed out. And immediately Judas, verse 49, came up to Jesus and said, greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. The word rabbi means master or teacher. So Judas is calling Jesus his master or teacher, even as he was betraying him. But Jesus said to him, friend, friend, why have you come? You know, I find it hard to imagine the depth of sadness that must have been in Jesus' voice at that moment to call him friend. Why have you come? Jesus knew full well what Judas was doing. And Judas knew that Jesus knew why he had come. But Jesus didn't condemn Judas. He just simply addressed him as friend. So this evening, while experiencing dread and agony and emotional upheaval, he now experiences betrayal. Have you ever been betrayed by someone you trusted? You ever remember what that felt like? Few things hurt as bad or cut as deeply as being betrayed. And trust goes out the window. For us, especially. So he was betrayed. Continuing, they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him. And suddenly, one of those who were with Jesus, Peter, stretched out his hand, drew his sword, struck the servant of the high priest, and cut off his ear. Now, he was aiming for the head, and all he got was the ear. And the servant's name was Malchus. Read that in John 18. He was aiming for the head. But Jesus said to him, put your sword in its place, for all who take up the sword will perish by the sword. Jesus wasn't going to perish by the sword. He was going to perish by an illegal trial at the hands of the people on behalf of all of humanity. Or do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? My mind goes back to that experience when Elijah, his servant, was so beside himself because here comes Jezebel and, oh, we're doomed, we're doomed. And Elijah says, open his mind. And the hills were surrounded by angels and chariots. So whatever takes place in our life, we must know it's God's will because he can certainly intervene. Do you not think I can now pray to my Father and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen thus? You know, Luke records that Jesus reached out in this time of trouble and healed Malchus's ear. Even while he was under stress, he was showing mercy. Verse 55, in that hour, Jesus said to the multitudes, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you, teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. They grabbed the teacher, and while they tried to be close to the teacher, listening to the teacher, wanting to hear all those bits of wisdom that he had, they now ran for their lives. John tells us that Jesus told the mob, since I'm the one you're looking for, let the rest of these disciples go, basically, and they did. He knew that he had to face what was coming by himself. The betrayal of Judas was part of Christ's sacrifice because enduring betrayal is one of the things we suffer because of sin. Sin does not have consequences only for the sinner. Sin affects the lives of others. There's many parallels here in what we're reading. One of the greatest acts of betrayal a man can commit is to betray his wife and children by fooling around with another man's wife, cheating. And a man who commits adultery betrays his wife, he betrays his children, he sets the stage for a lifelong of suffering. And who's affected? People who did no harm. The children did no harm. That kind of betrayal goes deep. It was necessary that Jesus the Christ, who had done no harm, suffer betrayal to experience what it feels like to be betrayed. So he experienced dread and agony. He experienced betrayal. Now he experiences abandonment. The fact that sin has consequences for those who are innocent is also reflected in abandonment of Jesus Christ by all his closest friends. They just ran. Just as children are abandoned by their father, they will suffer having done no wrong. Jesus Christ was abandoned. Jesus Christ was arrested, betrayed, and abandoned by his very closest friends. And then he was made a victim of their lies. Dread, great emotion, agony. He went through so much. Then betrayal, abandonment. Imagine coming home and all the toys and the luggage is all gone. And you have no idea where the family members went because they'd had enough. Abandoned. Jesus had to suffer abandonment by those he trusted, by those who were closest to him, to know what it feels like. It's really quite the story from the end of the Passover service. When they sang a hymn and they left, what takes place now? This truly is the temptation of Christ. Have you ever been lied about? At work, relationships, friendships, whatnot? Remember what that felt like? How did it make you feel? Oh, I was in agony. I was in high school, and it was hard enough being a teen in high school. But then someone decided to have fun and tell a lie about me. And I was quite devastated, as were my friends who chose not to talk to me for a while until they found out it was all a lie. And then, thankfully, they repented of it somewhat. Have you ever been lied about? How did it make you feel? Probably made you feel disgusted and sick to your stomach and violated. It's happened to me at work. I mean, in 34 years in one company, somebody's bound to not like you. And I've had that happen. Jesus no doubt felt the same way when it happened to him. Verse 57. And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard, and he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. He's very curious. He wants to see what's going on. He needs to be still near his master, wants to exercise his bravado that he had before. So he's closer. Now the chief priest, 59, the elders and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death. See, there was no true accusations of Jesus Christ. I've said before that the trial of Jesus Christ was illegal, and that if there was ever a true accusation, Jesus couldn't be our salvation. It had all to be lies. So the high priest sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. They couldn't even find false testimony. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. You know what this means? It means that there were those who would lie about it, but they interviewed them separately, and they couldn't find two that lied the same because they needed by the word of two or more witnesses. So they had liars wanting to kill Jesus, but they couldn't get their story straight. Finally, they did find two who agreed. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days.'" Now, the most you would say is convict the man of being crazy with these accusations. Hardly a crime to be executed for. And of course, it wasn't exactly what Jesus Christ had said anyway, but they weren't going to let that stop them. They had found their two witnesses. And the high priest arose in verse 62 and said to him, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest answered and said to him, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus said to him, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes, saying, "He has spoken blasphemy." You see, he put himself equal with God. And that is blasphemy in the Jewish religion. "What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, now you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" And they answered and said, "He is deserving of death." What the high priest did was convict Jesus Christ on false witnesses, but also their interpretation of his own statements. It's a very fascinating discussion on the legality of Jesus' trial. So he was lied about, and he had to face the lies. But he wasn't done during this struggle and time that he was going through. Verse 67, Then they spat in his face and beat him, and others struck him with the palms of their hands, saying, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who is the one who struck you?" Mark's gospel adds that they blindfolded him so that he couldn't see. Here in what is supposedly a court of law, the highest court in the land, the judges, the officers, and the guards were gathered around him like a pack of wolves, spitting on him, slapping him around, punching him, a man who could not defend himself, a man who was innocent. And he endured humiliation. He endured humiliation. Have you ever needed to just be humble before an accusation that has gone on and you can't defend yourself? You may have had dread, you may have had betrayal, you may have been feeling abandoned, you've been lied to, and now you still need to be humble. And he accepted this humiliation. He accepted this humiliation. Sin, by its very nature, hurts people. It hurts you, it hurts me, it hurts people you know, people you love, people you care about, even hurts total strangers, people that you don't know. To deal with sin, Jesus Christ had to suffer the humiliation and the beating that was due us. All have sinned and come short of God's glory. Now, while this was going on, remember, our friend Peter was at the back of the group there, back with the servants, trying to find out what's happening. Now, while this was going on, now Peter, verse 69, sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him saying, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." What? I'm just here by myself. What? What he's going through, I don't want to go through. But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you are saying." And when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were near, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." And he again denied with an oath, "I do not know the man." That should end it. I have made my statement. And a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, "Surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you." Everything about you says that you know Jesus of Nazareth. Then he began to curse and swear, I do not know the man. And immediately a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus who had said to him, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. He went out and wept bitterly. Jesus Christ now suffered denial, being denied by his close friends, being denied by those who were his followers. It was one of the things that happens to us as well. And it happens to us because of sin. But there, you know, we have a hope. Because having denied Jesus Christ, Peter repented and became one of the most outspoken, effective, powerful Christian teachers of our time. If you take a look at what took place, Acts 2, 50 days after his denial of Christ, was a great, powerful sermon. A different man. A different man. Titus 1:16 shows us that we deny Christ by our works. We deny Christ by what we say, by what we do. When we ourselves have denied Jesus Christ by what we said and do, there is hope for us because we can turn around. We can repent as Peter did. So Jesus Christ endured dread and agony. He endured being lied about. He endured being betrayed, endured being lied about. He endured humiliation. Have you ever been the object of a conspiracy? Again, back in my 34 years at the Rocket Factory, I have. Someone wanted my job and was working behind the scenes to get it. You know, I could feel the knife right between the shoulder blades. Let's go to Matthew 27. Matthew 27. Oh, we're right there. Never mind. Yeah, Matthew 27, verse 1. Again, continuing on from the end of the Passover service. When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death. It was a plot. It was a conspiracy. We're going to make this happen. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned and by betraying innocent blood. What was Judas thinking? Apparently, it wasn't until he saw Jesus condemned that he realized what he had done. And he says, no, here, take the money back. This has been a terrible, terrible mistake. And did they say, oh, we're sorry, we should let him go? No, that's not what happened. They said, that's your problem, not ours. What is it to us? You see to it. Then he threw down, verse 5, then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. You know, being sorry isn't enough. Blood had to be shed. Pain has to be felt. Because what happens with sin, it's not necessarily the punishment, but the consequences. There is a difference. God can punish us if he sees that it's to our best interest. And the reason God punishes us for sin is to turn us around, to correct us so that we'll change our life and not do what we're doing. But mostly what happens isn't from punishment, but the natural consequence that follows on the heels of sin. We are punished by the consequence. And when it's done, it just can't be instantly undone. Here, in the actions of Judas and the suffering of Jesus Christ, we see this being played out, that being sorry is not enough. Sin has consequences. And the only way we can be delivered from those consequences is by the suffering and the shame and the blood of Jesus Christ. Now, concerning those coins, verse 6, the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful to put them in the treasury, because they are the price of blood. And they consulted together and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore, the field has been called the field of blood to this day, to the time of the writing. Then it was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, and they took 30 pieces of silver, the value of him who was priced, whom they of the children of Israel priced, and gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He's been through a brutal night. He's been through an illegal trial. Not quite done yet. And Jesus said to him, "Yeah, it is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Again, he was being accused and lied about, and he chose not to respond. Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he answered him not a word, so the governor marveled greatly. Now, verse 15, at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing the multitude, one prisoner whom they wished. You get this whole scene that's taking place. I will release this innocent man versus Barabbas, who's a murderer and a thief. Who do I release? Why are you pointing to Barabbas? No, this innocent man. He's an innocent man. I find no problem with him. And of course, they yelled out for Barabbas. Verse 17, therefore they had gathered together. Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is the called Christ?" For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. Envy, a conspiracy, lies, betrayal. Pilate knew that it was all a setup and a sham. He knew what was appearing to be right. He knew what was appearing to be wrong. And he had a sense that the people would choose Barabbas to be freed and not Jesus Christ. But he let it play out. While he was sitting on a judgment seat, his wife said to him, his wife came to him and says, "Have nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him." She was having issues with her dreams about Jesus Christ. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And what should we do? Verse 22, let him be crucified. An innocent man. Did nothing wrong. Let him be crucified. What evil has he done? Verse 23, and they cried out all the more, let him be crucified. So he washed his hands, got a towel, rubbed him off. Then he said, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. It's a huge thing to say. So they released Barabbas and they scourged Jesus the Christ. They took him over to be crucified, and before that they scourged him. Now scourging is a terrible punishment in itself. Scourging is done with a short whip with several strips of leather into which they embed bone and rock. Pieces of metal, and they flay a man alive. The Roman soldier is called a lictor. He is a trained individual to administer the beating. He knew how to wrap the whip around the body so that it cut and flayed the flesh. Many, many individuals died from the scourging by itself. Before they could be crucified, it was excruciatingly painful and bloody. If you want to read about the results of the beating, you can go to Psalm 22, verse 17, where he says, I count all my bones. They look and stare at me. The skin was open to the bones. We had a situation with our stupid dog, and I had a cut on its leg, and there was no bone, no organs there, but you pull back the flap, you see the bone. Of course, we raced over to the doctor place, veterinarian, and had it sit stitched up. But there, the skin separated, we could see the bones. John's gospel says that after the scourging, Pilate again brought Jesus before the crowd, hoping that they would think that he had been punished enough and that would let him go, but instead they cried out more and more for his crucifixion. Verse 27, then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him, and they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And when they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head, mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They spat on him and took a reed and struck him on the head. So here was yet another round of humiliation and shame. He was being spat upon, mocked, slapped around. Yet it was all necessary because there are two elements of the Passover symbols that we take. We all know of the wine, which symbolizes his blood poured out in our place. But there's also the bread, which symbolizes his bruised, battered, and bleeding body, whereby we can go before the mercy seat, the throne of grace, asking God's intervention and healing on our part. And then Jesus Christ, the end of the scourging, was crucified. Verse 35, they crucified him. Now, there are three types of beams. There's crux simplex, which is simply a straight up and down beam, and the arms are together over his head, and their legs, the feet are together, and they're pounded, and it's called crux simplex. Then there is crux emisa, which is the T, which has got a T at the top, and the arms are stretched out, and again, the feet are together. And then there is the crux comisa, which is the iconic T, which we see a lot on crucifix somewhere. And the crossbar is not all the way at the top. And usually, and what happens is, you know, they're pounded not in the hand because the hand would rip, but here in the wrist. And sometimes they didn't even do the wrist, they just tied them up because all the weight was on the feet. And when the feet gave out, the arms would hang out and the individual would die of asphyxiation. I mean, it's a horrible way to go. So they would put him on this board, and then they would raise him up, and thump, it would go into the ground, and then he would be in total agony, in total agony. So they crucified him. Verse 35, they divided his garments, casting lots that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the prophet. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. He had nothing left. It was just him. And then Pilate, you could read this in Matthew 27, Luke 23, John 19. They put the accusation over his head in three languages, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, that said, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Of course, nobody there in the crowd wanted that. And he said, "What I've done, I've done. Shut up, go away." And those who were crucified with him blasphemed him, wagging their heads along with the crowd. "You who destroyed the temple and built it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Verse 40. 41. "Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and the elders, said, 'He saved others, he cannot save himself. If he is the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross and we will believe.'" You know, if we see it take place in front of us, we will believe. The Jews always sought a sign. The Greeks always sought logic. Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. Even as he was getting ready to die, he was experiencing humility. He was a public spectacle. Crucifixion was a public execution. It wasn't done in private. It was designed to deter anyone else from being so arrogant and flippant as to go against Rome. Crucifixions were often carried out along major roads. So when you enter the city or leave the city, you're seeing the individuals who were murdered, for want of a better term. And this is at the time of the Passover feast, so tens of thousands of people would have been arriving and coming and going and seeing him hanging there in shame and disgrace. Jesus Christ did something very important. Let's go to John 19. Switch over to John 19. Again, this gives us a perspective on what Jesus Christ went through to be our sacrifice. When we go through the Passover service, we go through the service that he gave with his disciples. But this is what he actually went through. In John 19, verse 25, Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. See, it was a small crowd. Everybody else left him. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by, John, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple, John, took her to his own home. He was still thinking out for others. He was still thinking out for his mother. You know, it's hard to think of what it would mean to a mother stand there and see the son crucified. That's your flesh and blood up there. Humiliated, betrayed, denied, now crucified. Dying in the late afternoon sun, and to see his life ebbing and ending. See, at that time, probably didn't register with Mary that Jesus would be resurrected. And he was all alone. Verse 28, it comes to a conclusion. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, said, "I thirst." A vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a hyssop, and put it to his mouth. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." Bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Therefore, because it was the preparation day that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day. You see, many people think, oh, there's just the Sabbath. Jews know the Sabbath is a high day, therefore they try and calculate how do you get 3 days and three nights. We won't go into that right now. But this was the first day, they're getting into the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the Jews asked Pilate that they break their legs, that they might be taken away. We don't want them hanging on the cross during a high day. Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who was crucified with him. The idea was to speed up the death so that they would suffocate. That's basically really what the crucifixion was. And if they were still breathing, if they hadn't died yet, they would take a glove, smash the prisoner's leg, and they would no longer raise themselves up to breathe, and they would suffocate within a few minutes. But what happened when they came to Jesus? He was already dead. They didn't break his bones because he was already dead. Verse 34, but one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. It should be noted that if you are dead, you don't have blood pressure to have blood spew out of you. This is when Jesus Christ died. And he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, so that you may believe. Verse 36, for these things were done that the scripture should be fulfilled, not one of his bones shall be broken. And then again another scripture says, they shall look on him whom they pierced. They shall look on him who they pierced. Jesus Christ died from bleeding when he was scourged. If I have a paper cut, the silly thing bleeds. Well, he had his body flayed and his body bled. And he was pierced in the side, and his final blood poured out. And it says water, which probably is some of the internal liquids that are there. He died the way all sacrifices died, the shedding of blood. He died the same way animal sacrifices took place for 1,400 years leading up to that event. All those sacrifices were a shadow of what was to take place that evening, which that we now look back on. The real cause of Jesus' death was the cutting of his body and the pouring out of blood in the same way of every sacrifice that was ever offered in the temple. What's very important to take away from this message is that the application of Jesus Christ's sacrifice, everything that he went through, is not for a group, is not for an organization. It's for us as individuals. It is for us personally, to you personally, to me personally, to the individual. It's personal. Everything that Jesus Christ went through is so that he, as our intercessor, sitting next to the right hand of God, can say, I know what they've been through. I've been there. I've experienced that. And I apply my sacrifice on that individual's part. We can go to Isaiah 53. We can go through what took place for time's sake. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. We hid our faces from him. He was despised, not esteemed. He was stricken, borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. We even esteemed him stricken by God and afflicted. Do sometimes we think that Jesus Christ is really our sacrifice? You know, do we really see that he is our salvation? When someone took a sacrifice, they were a sin sacrifice. They were there when that animal was slain. They saw it up close and personal. That lamb died for the individual. It didn't die for a group or a class of people. It was that individual alone. Is that how we see Christ's sacrifice? That little lamb dying in front of us because of us, because of what we've done. As we prepare for the Passover, we examine ourselves. These are some serious things to be thinking about. Jesus Christ experienced all that we go through. There isn't anything that he wasn't tempted with, and yet he didn't sin. He experienced dread and agony. He experienced betrayal. He experienced abandonment. He experienced lies, humiliation, denial. He experienced a conspiracy. He saw the consequence of sin on himself. He went through a scourging and then was crucified, that his death can become personal to us. It is very personal to us. Jesus Christ learned from what he suffered what it's like to be a human being so that he could be a faithful high priest. As he was dying, Jesus Christ said, he made intercession for even those transgressors, saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. And how often that would be good for us to remember too, that those who would despitefully use us, those who would lie about us, they really don't know what they're doing. As our high priest, he can now constantly make intercession for us. Because he experienced all that we can experience. He went through everything that we can go through. And he learned from what he suffered so that he could become our faithful high priest. He knows what we've gone through. Do we truly appreciate and understand what he went through for us as individuals? Something to think about as we go forward toward the Passover. Hope that was helpful.